Moby Dick is in one way separate, different, apart from the other works we've been looking at in the past few days, and the Flannery O'Connor works that we will be beginning with tonight and looking at tomorrow and much of next week. All of the other works, Dante, Shakespeare, Eliot, Flannery O'Connor, are Christian in nature. They are literary works that are helping explore the truths of the faith. They do it in varied ways, obviously, because they come from varied time periods. Even within the operatic version of Othello, Verdi comes out of a Catholic country. So that even though it is a work of 19th century romanticism, the truths of the faith are present in there. Verdi writes a gorgeous Ave Maria as part of the work. Moby Dick is a profane book. And by that, I don't necessarily mean it's blasphemous, although it can at times be viewed that way. I simply mean that it is a work that is not in and of itself directly connected with the truths of the faith, but it's written by a man who is wrestling with a demon. It is written by a man who never once in his entire life, though he was haunted by questions of religion, pursued by the grand visions of God, never found peace. So what we have here is a mind, a work that I would call God-haunted. It is the principal idea, if you will, of the entire work. But for much of the work, we are quite literally at sea. We are pursuing something that is overpowering, that can finally never really be caught, can never finally be overcome. And the entire setup of the book, from the way it's structured, through the plot, through the characters, to the basic ideas, are connected with this problem. Now, why look at it then? It is well worth study, and is well worth study for a number of reasons. First and foremost, most of us in this room are American. Moby Dick is the great American work of literature, period. There's nothing else that equals it. There's nothing else in the same league with it. When America finally falls, as all civilizations rise up and fall, when the last golden arch is knocked down to the ground by the last barbarian, when all the money has been taken away and the land is barren and there are just a few random tribes running around again, savagely, brutally attacking each other, the fact is that the entire history of our land will be remembered for two things alone. I say this always to my students, they don't believe me. This is true. I know this to be true. Our country will be remembered for two things. Number one, we were the first country who, through our great science and engineering skills, managed to step off the planet. Americans set foot on another planet. That is an extraordinary achievement, absolutely extraordinary achievement. And it was only possible because we were at heart a profoundly scientific, technologically oriented society. That's the first thing we'll be remembered for. The second thing is for a book about a whale. And it is very odd that this novel, which was not well received in its own day, the great American novel first had to be printed in England because no American publisher would touch it. And then when it had been published in England, since it had a stamp of approval from abroad, then the American publishers would publish it. And all told, it sold maybe, I don't know, 5-6 copies. There were a handful of critics who at the beginning recognized its brilliance. Just a handful. Most people thought it was simply a crazy book by a crazy man. Very few people read it. It then sank into a kind of oblivion and was not well known. There was a little Melville Renaissance in the 1920s. The book became known again, and some critics began reading it and proclaiming its genius, and it is a work of genius, no getting around it, began proclaiming its genius, but at the same time, nobody really read it. I think it's fair to say that there is no other great book written by a great countryman that the populace simply refuses to read. And one reason for that is not just the length, not just the complexity, but this is a book that makes you very uncomfortable as you read it. It is, if you will, looking in a mirror. We who are Americans see ourselves in this book, and it's a very disturbing picture. It's much better to set it aside and turn on something that's much more pleasant, like singing nuns. Makes us feel all warm and runny inside. Moby Dick does not give us that effect. So I'm making a claim. It is the great American work, but Americans don't know it. Example, earlier this summer, I've been visiting my parents, and after dinner every night, we have a little family ritual. We go in and watch a TV game show called Wheel of Fortune, where the contestants spin this wheel and make money and then put letters up on a board and then have to guess what the saying is. It's relatively harmless. But they had college week on Wheel of Fortune. So they had graduating seniors from prestigious American universities. And they're playing the game, and they have this phrase up there, and it's identified as a phrase. So they're spinning the wheel and buying letters, and there's a young man who is a graduating senior from William and Mary in Virginia, very prestigious school, and he's beginning to figure out what it is, and you can tell he has no idea what this phrase is, and the phrase is, call me Ishmael. And so he finally gets enough letters up there and he's able to guess what it is, but you can see on his face it's like... So he says, do you want to solve the puzzle? Yes. Is it, call me Ishmael? That's right, you win! And there's applause. And then there's a chance to win an additional $1,000. So the host comes over and says, and now for an additional $1,000, this is the opening line of what great novel? And the graduating senior from William and Mary goes, the Bible? So not only is the book unread, it's unread in our major universities, and which are turning out blithering ignoramuses. It's a great book. It's a great book. I'll try to justify that claim as we go along. Briefly, Melville's life is fascinating. I could go on at length about it, but let me just give you a few things you need to know in terms of being able to read the book. Melville was born in 1819. His life pretty much spans the 19th century. Born in 1819 into a once prominent New York family. The Melvilles were fairly prominent, and on both sides of the family there was some social prominence, but the family was falling into decay, falling on hard times. Melville's father died early, having seen the collapse of the family fortune, the family good name. Financial instability took hold. Melville had a number of brothers and sisters. He began taking odd jobs, trying to help support the family. And then finally, as a quite a young man, I believe he was only about 18 or 19 years old, he hopped a ship and sailed off. So that all of the nautical business in Moby Dick comes from personal experience. The young Melville was a sailor. He had gone to sea. Unfortunately, the ship he got on had a tyrannical captain. And when he made it to the South Seas, he and a fellow sailor decided they couldn't stand being on the ship anymore, and they jumped ship. They deserted the ship and went to an island where they hid out until the ship was gone. They discovered themselves to be on an island in the South Seas inhabited by the Taipei Indians, who turned out to be cannibals. So he found himself having jumped ship at home on a cannibal island. Fortunately, the cannibals were rather friendly. And Melville got a kind of phony idea there of a sort of island paradise. You will find Moby Dick is loaded with references that seem to come out of Rousseau, that the whole notion of the noble savage and the uncorrupted nature that is close, that is living in a kind of native simplicity. He obviously had read Rousseau, but many of his ideas come from the fact that he had spent time in the South Seas and had a romantic vision of the life there. A vision not necessarily accurate. He did not spend a great deal of time there. But it represented something to him that he held dear for the rest of his life. He managed to get on another ship, and the ship going home was involved in a mutiny. He then got off the ship again, worked for a while in Hawaii, and then sailed home with the U.S. Navy. This was when he was a very young man. So by the time he had entered his 20s, he had already had a life rich in experience. He made a couple of other tours, including a voyage on a whaling vessel, so that he knew this firsthand. He had been there. He had seen this. It had happened. He then returned and began writing travel books, mainly about his early adventures as a young sailor. And the first book he wrote was called Taipei, about a fictional account of a sailor who goes to these islands. It was quite successful. Melville's first book was his most successful, and the career went downhill from there. The more he became a serious artist, the more he began examining serious questions, the fewer people wanted to read his books. Especially as the books became tinged with metaphysics, as those questions in his mind began to assume more and more prominence and he began to explore those in his writing, more and more the readership turned off to him and was not interested. He married, he became a family man, he was a difficult man to live with, he was a stern father. His wife had a very difficult life. His eldest son committed suicide at an early age. And you get that sense of the torment in the man. It shows up in the works. Moby Dick was published in 1851. The high point artistically for Melville's career, but as I said, the book was a failure. His next novel, Pierre, was an even more dismal failure. And in fact, at that point, the critics did pronounce him insane and said that the man should be institutionalized. His friend Nathaniel Hawthorne, to whom Moby Dick is dedicated, by the way, Hawthorne suggested that Melville try writing short fiction. He did that for a while, couldn't make a living at it, and finally got a job working in a customs house in New York City and spent the rest of his life as a customs officer. He was basically a bureaucrat. Gave up writing fiction, turned to writing poetry, wrote some interesting poetry, but he was not a natural poet. The poetry is stilted to a degree. There are some good poems. It's worth reading, including a long poem called Clairel, C-L-A-R-E-L. That's a very strange work. Melville made a tour to the Holy Lands. And this is an account of a young man who goes off to the Holy Lands, a long, strange poem. But he got it published, but again, it no sales, very little reaction to it. He died in 1891. Having just retired from the customs house, and among his papers found in his desk after his death, another work of fiction. that he apparently had been working on at the in his last days, called Billy Budd. Absolute masterpiece. At the end of his life, one more. It's a long short story, a short novel called Billy Budd that is a superb piece of work. He had not lost his talent. But Billy Budd, again, a work filled with questions. Again, that sense of the tormented soul that could never find peace. Now, why couldn't Melville find peace? We have to go to his background. And I think if you look at the world out of which he comes, you get some sense of the turbulence. Melville's father was a Unitarian. The Unitarians were very prominent in the East Coast at that time, particularly in the state of New York. And basically, the Unitarians denied the Christian message. They would accept that there was a God, but it was not a Trinitarian God, hence the name Unitarian. There is a God, he is designer of the universe, there is a creator, there is a creative force, but we don't know much about him. So we're basically worshiping something that is unknown. We have not looked on the face of God. We cannot know the face of God. That was Melville's father's religious vision. Melville's mother was a Presbyterian, a stern Calvinist. There is a God. The Christian story is indeed true, but the God is an unforgiving God, a harsh God, an unyielding God, and everything is predestined. You are saved or you are damned, and you cannot know. And the fact of the matter is most folks are damned. And that hard, dark vision was the other part of Melville's religious background. And then, of course, he was raised in an American world that was, to a large degree, indifferent to religion, concerned with other things, making money, for example. A world that he paid lip service to faith, but not terribly interested in. This was the man's background. So that you had in his head these questions whirling about, simply whirling about, and he never found any peace. He grappled with them. It is important to understand that in heading into Moby Dick, because the vision of God in Moby Dick is to a large degree determined by the Calvinist vision. There's no getting around it, and we will talk about that as we look at the book more closely. Now, there are other curiosities here. There's a reason why this book, in some ways, is off-putting. For example, and let me start with this. What I'm going to try to do today is sort of give you a guide into the book. We're just going to make inroads into the book. I'm trying to give you some sense of how to read it. I imagine many of you have not gotten through it. Many of you are probably just starting it. There are peculiarities here. You're going to run into various walls along the way. Some people of goodwill put the book down simply because it's so odd they can't continue with it. Let's start with a major oddity. Before we can get to the book, we get an etymology. Most books do not begin with an etymology. And before we even get to the word list itself, we have this curiosity. Etymology supplied by a late consumptive usher to a grammar school. This is Melville. This is Melville. Melville was a very funny man. Who was possessed of a very dark vision. The pale usher, usher being a sort of assistant schoolmaster, the pale usher, threadbare in coat, heart, body, and brain, I see him now. He was ever dusting his old lexicons and grammars with a queer handkerchief, mockingly embellished with all the gay flags of all the known nations of the world. He loved to dust his old grammars. It somehow mildly reminded him of his mortality. It's wonderfully funny stuff. It's deeply moving. What is it doing at the beginning of the book? What is it doing there? Before we get to the novel, we could pause and talk at length about that curious little paragraph. Let me just put it briefly. You have the vision of a man who loves words, who's cast aside, who is isolated, who is alone, who finds those things he loved quite literally covered with dust. Nobody else around him cares about it. And yet, what does he have? A world vision, and that vision, in fact, is on his very handkerchief. He is consumptive, he is dying, and he knows it. He is pale, he is old, he is worn out. This is Melville writing this when he is only, when he's only 32 years old. But there's a hint of the man himself as the book begins, and dusting off the old grammars that he knows nobody's going to pick up. Boom. Little vision of the author, I would say, as the book begins. And then, wail. The whole list, a couple of definitions, where the word comes from, and then a list of the word whale in various languages. Then we turn the page again. Extracts supplied by a sub-librarian. Another little joke. I won't take the time to go through this, but again, the little introductory passage there. Rather moving, quite funny, and then we get page after page of references from other works about whales. Page after, I mean, from the Bible. And by the way, Melville did know his Bible backwards and forwards. He read it constantly. It was his brain was defined to a large degree by the Bible. He was a man who read the Bible and took it seriously, even if he wrestled with what it was saying, and finally could never come to rest and believe the message that was there. But he took it seriously, and he knew it. And he knew it. Page after page after page of these quotations about whales. Now, we get through the first few pages of the book before we get to the narrative proper, and we can assume we're going to read a book about a whale. Why a whale? Well, let me posit one possible answer. Melville, in his early 30s, sits down to write a book. What he himself said, he was going to attempt to write a major work. He was young, he was a writer, he was ambitious, he had turned out some books. He was now going to try to write a big book. And that simply means an author taking on big questions. An author, the mind of an intelligent writer, trying to look into the mystery of life and sort it out. Now, if I look at life, life is contained with a multiplicity of things that are mysterious. We live in a mysterious world. A great writer, any thinker, knows that. The world is mysterious, and the world is huge. How do you begin? You want to try to get some handle on it. You want to explore it. Melville, I would posit, came up with an idea. All right? If we're going to try to understand what this life is about, what is the meaning of it all, what the world is about and how it functions, I can't take on the whole world. I don't have the energy. I don't have the time. It's not possible. So what I will do is I will select one object. I will take out of that world one concrete object, and I will explore that object in every possible way, manner, shape that it can possibly be explored. He had been a sailor. He had been on a whaling voyage. At some point, he had been at sea and seen the Leviathan come up out of the ocean and said, I will write a book about the whale. The whale. Because if I'm trying to get at the core of the mystery of life, if I am trying to understand, is there a creator, and if there is, who is he, and what is the created world, where does it come from, and what does it mean, then I will take one created item out of that world. He could have taken, I suppose, a lemon, or a bicycle. He could have taken the moon, or he could have taken a grain of sand and written an equivalent book. But he chooses the whale. And from the first page of this book until the last page of this book, you are smacked in the face with the whale. You cannot get away from it. Now, if that is what he is doing in a literary sense or a metaphysical sense, I am taking one object and I will explore it to the depth of its being, every aspect of it. I will essentially write about nothing else other than that which pertains to the whale and whaling. He then creates a plot, a storyline, about one man who is obsessed with one whale. Okay? We particularize it, if you will. If we have one author who's writing one book about one subject, and that's the whale, and he's going to pursue that whale until he has wrung the last ounce of meaning from it, we are going to have that book be about one man, a captain, who is pursuing one particular whale, and that becomes the focus of his whole life. And we get Captain Ahab and Moby Dick. It is extremely peculiar, if you think about it, to write a literary work in which the central conflict, that which drives the book, is between a man and a beast. We could say the protagonist is Ahab. The antagonist is a big blob of blubber that no one's quite sure where it is, because the Leviathan is out there swimming around. And much of the book, we're simply out there trying to find this whale. But it's out there somewhere. It can be located. It has a history. It connects with the principal character. It bit his leg off at one point. So that not only do we have the man and the object, we have animosity. We have deep hatred and animosity between the created man and the created creature. The two have turned on each other. We do not have a vision of nice, calm, peaceful waters sailing about on a sunny day with the little fishies leaping in a... There is fury. There is anger. There is a will to destroy that animates this whole book. Now, the form is perfect. If that's what he intended to do, the form he chose is perfect. And by the form, I mean a novel. I can't give you a full history of the novel. Let me give you a thumbnail sketch of what a novel is and why it's perfect, given that I am, given what I am hinting at as Melville's intention. The novel comes along in the early 17th century. To put it quite simply, there would be no novel had there been no printing press. The novel and the printing press are directly connected. When books could finally be printed, when it was possible to publish books, when books became more readily available through technology and also through the rise of the middle class, As more and more machinery came into the world, people had a bit more money and a bit more freedom, and they wanted a bit more entertainment. And not yet being blessed with the ability to turn on the TV set, they turned to books, and they started buying books. But being middle class to a large degree, what they wanted to read about was themselves. What they were most interested in was seeing a kind of mirror. And when the novel is born out of an artistic desire to present the world in its realistic detail to a reading public that wanted to read about itself. That's just simply stated. Most people say that the first great novel, and in some ways the first real novel, is Cervantes' Don Quixote. And it's true. That novel begins with Alonso de Cahana, who goes nuts reading romances. He's reading chivalric romances. They are not novels. They deal with knights who are having glorious adventures, but in a totally unreal world. What makes Quixote a novel is this man goes nuts and gets himself, takes his old horse, puts on an old suit of armor, and puts a barber's basin on his head, and rides out into the real world to be a knight. What defines Quixote as a novel is that our knight rides out on the actual dusty roads of Spain and goes from village to village. And as he rides along, Cervantes gives us what the great novels from that point until the present day will always give us, detail. What the roads are like, what the people are like, how the people speak, what they eat, the kind of clothing they wear. The novel is able to do something that Shakespeare doesn't do in Othello, that Dante doesn't do in the Divine Comedy, and that is give us realistic detail. So that when you are reading a great novel, what you are being given is a realistic world in its totality. So if you want to know what Spain was like in the early 17th century, what lived life was like, how the people lived day by day, what they thought, what they said, how they acted, you pick up Quixote, and there it is. If you want to know what life was like in Russia at the time of the Napoleonic Wars, what the people wore, how they talked, what they ate, how they related to each other, you pick up War and Peace. You want a vision of what life was like in Puritan New England, in that, those closed, restrictive societies, you pick up Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter. You want Victorian England, the streets of London, and the way people lived in the age of Victoria, you pick up David Copperfield. And if you want to know what life on a whaling ship was like in the 19th century, and that world is gone, there are no more whaling ships, it doesn't happen anymore, it has vanished, you want to know what that was about, here it is. Because every possible detail about the life of a whaler and a whaling ship is in this book. And hence, the form is perfect for what Melville was doing. In fact, there are times you choke on the detail reading this book. There are times when you turn the page and it's another chapter about the spout hole of a whale. And you're going, please, please. Is there a story here? What's he got? Now we get, please, 6 pages about the spout hole of a whale? Is he crazy? Well, yes and no. In one sense, yes, because what we want is entertainment. On the other hand, no, because he is instructing us. I'm back to that duality I set up at the beginning of our lectures. To entertain and to educate. To delight and to instruct. And what Melville does in this book, almost to death, is instruct us on whales. Why is he doing it? Because he is exploring one creature in every possible perspective, and that includes whole chapters on the spout hole. There it is. And he will give it to us with all the detail that he can possibly have, even if it drives us crazy. Because we are going to look at this thing, we will not remove our vision from that creature. Because only by exploring it to the very end, from the incredible blank head of it to the tip of its tail, from the spout hole to its private parts, a very funny chapter in there that I won't comment on. Only if we look at every aspect of this thing can we possibly, maybe, perhaps get to the core of what the mystery of life itself is. And that's what he's after. And the novel's the way of doing it. One other thing about the structure and the problem with reading this book. The book is indeed designed like a whaling voyage. Moby Dick is of all the books in the world, Moby Dick is the easiest book to abridge. Because you will have a chapter or two of action where something happens, and then you will have 15 chapters where nothing happens, and all you do is stare at another part of that fish. So that if you want to abridge the book, all you have to do is take out those 15 chapters, because for the most part they have nothing to do with the action of the novel, and you can squeeze the novel down to a rather small little book. In doing so, you have lost the book. And part of that, again, is not just in its idea, but also in its form, in that he is giving us a whaling voyage. You want to know what it's like out at sea, going fishing for whales? You sit and sit and sit, day after day after day, and you stare at the sea, and you stare at the dead whale you caught last time, and you stare at your fellow crewmen, and you wonder about the captain, and you stare at the sea some more, and then you stare at the fish again, and then you have and then the mind begins roaming, and then all of a sudden, boom, a fish appears and there's action. And all of a sudden there is action and a lot of action, and it's very exciting, and you get the whale or you don't get the whale, and then it's gone, and then you stare at the whale, and you stare at the sea, and you stare at your fellow crewmen, and you stare at some part of the ship. The book is designed to be a whaling cruise. And if you think Moby Dick is boring, never go out on a cruise ship. Okay? Because that is what the book is giving us. It is lifelike in that way. In doing it, he is also giving us a fact of life. There are long stretches in our life when it is just day after day after day, the same thing more, and then we get a little bit of excitement, and what we want is nonstop excitement. I want to chase that whale every day. I want that big battle and excitement every day. And Melville knows better. And Melville is, in this sense, very much a truth teller. He will just tell us what's there. Now, let's get into the book. All that by way of background. Let's get into the book. Curiosity here. We have a narrator. He says to call him Ishmael. We don't know if that's his real name or not. But he says, call me Ishmael. Okay? So what do we begin with? It is a very famous opening line. Call me Ishmael, chapter 1. Well, Ishmael, of course, being the son of Abraham by the bondservant Hagar. Okay? The son who is cast out. The son who is not allowed the inheritance, which goes instead to Isaac. And Ishmael becomes the outcast, the exile, the wanderer. So who's telling us this story? The story is being told to us by a man who knows he's an outsider. He's an outsider. He has lost his patrimony. And we begin with a narrator who is separate, alone, exiled, outcast, and knows it. And curiously, he is not seeking to be settled. He is seeking to go on again. The first paragraph of the book, I don't have the time to go through it in detail, is Ishmael telling us that he has decided to, being bored on shore, to sail about a little and see the watery part of the world. Now, on various levels, he's creating an interesting narrator, but at every step of the way, he's telling us something about who we are, and I'm speaking as an American. And if there is one thing that defines America and has from the start, it's an inability to settle down. A discontent. We are a land that does not want to settle. And once we even settle for a moment, we are filled with this turbulent desire to pull up and move again, to go on. It's our heritage. Everyone who was here to a degree came from somewhere else, was an exile, an outcast, cut off, choosing to leave something behind to come to someplace new, and then having come to someplace new, time to move on, boom, up and off we go again, okay? If it means going across the country, fine, hit to California, oh man, no more land now, well then I'm going to sea, and I'm out on the seas and I've conquered the seas, oh no more seas now, well, I'll go to the moon, okay? And we went. My point being, there is a connection between this whale book and going to the moon. The first paragraph of the book, our narrator suggests somebody who is quite capable of going to the moon. And it permeates everything, from that, which I think was a magnificent achievement, to go out to Route 61 and just watch those travel caravans go up and down that road. Mom and Dad retire and we finally do what? We don't go and tend the garden. We buy ourselves a big mobile home and we take to the road. Zoom! Finally I can be... And zooming all over the country. You know. Postcards to the kids. Yeah, we've retired and we're... But Grandpa and Grandpa aren't in rocking chairs on the front porch saying, it's been a good life. None of that stuff. It's what? I'm in my mobile home and greetings from Alberta. Great up here. You know, greetings from Phoenix. We're having a grand time. You know, Here we are in the Everglades. You know, love the alligators. You know what? It is this insane wanderlust. Americans cannot settle. Cannot settle. It's who we are. It's a deep-seated part of us. Let me do this at the beginning. I just want to give you a couple other quick visions of how every moment in this book, every moment in this book is American, is fully American. I'll give you a chapter here since we've got different editions. Look, chapter five, called Breakfast. Ishmael has decided to ship out. He's in New England. He's going to find a ship that he can go out on. He's wandering around the streets. And he's, the grinning landlord's there, he goes down to have breakfast. And breakfast begins, second paragraph, chapter 5. He decides he's going to have a pleasant breakfast with friends. He talks about the nature of laughter. However, a good laugh is a mighty good thing, and rather too scarce a good thing, the more is the pity. So if any one man in his own proper person affords stuff for a good joke to anybody, let him not be backward, but let him cheerfully allow himself to spend and be spent in that way. And the man that has anything bountifully laughable about him, be sure there is more in that man than you perhaps think for. This is Melville at his best. One of the great things of this book, these constant reflections that you have to have the patience to spend time with and be willing to read. They're wonderful, okay? So, this is Ishmael. He's going to have a hearty breakfast with some of his fellow sailors. People in this inn, he doesn't know them. We go down to breakfast. I'm at paragraph 8. These reflections just here are occasioned by the circumstance that after we were all seated at the table, and I was preparing to hear some good stories about whaling, to my no small surprise, nearly every man maintained a profound silence. And not only that, but they looked embarrassed. Yes, here were a set of sea dogs, many of whom, without the slightest bashfulness, had boarded great whales on the high seas, entire strangers to them, and dueled them dead without winking. And yet, here they sat at a social breakfast table, all of the same calling, all of kindred tastes, looking round as sheepishly at each other as though they had never been out of sight of some sheepfold among the green mountains. A curious sight, these bashful bears, these timid warrior whalemen. The vision is one of total isolation. The vision is of a society that is not social, cut off. And in the same way, we have the solo narrator who's moving through this world very much his own man. We find out nothing about his background, his family, where he comes from. He is a self-created man who names himself at the beginning of the book. And now he's seeking a little company, and he goes down to the breakfast room, and what does he find? Isolated souls. Someone in future days will pick up this book and say about Americans, at core, they were not social creatures. They were not social beings. They were solitary journeyers who were at their most content when they picked up, moved on their own. They were not bound by family, by place, by blood, but wanted to create themselves and new create themselves over and it's, there we are. There we are, and it may not be pleasant, but boy, is it accurate. Now, you could say, well, but we all sat up at the breakfast tables this morning. We were talking, we were laughing. And I would say to you, that's because those were Catholic breakfast tables. Look at the beginning of chapter 7. This is, again, the way the book is structured. We move from the breakfast chapter to the chapel. Chapter 7, the chapel. Ishmael walks the streets of New Bedford, goes into the whaleman's chapel. Second paragraph. Returning from my first morning stroll, I again sallied out upon this special errand. The sky had changed from clear, sunny, cold to driving sleet and mist. Wrapping myself in my shaggy jacket of the cloth called bearskin, I fought my way against the stubborn storm. entering, I found a small scattered congregation of sailors and sailors' wives and widows. A muffled silence reigned, only broken at times by the shrieks of the storm. Each silent worshiper seemed purposely sitting apart from the other, as if each silent grief were insular and incommunicable. The chaplain had not yet arrived, and there these silent islands of men and women sat steadfastly eyeing several marble tablets with black borders masoned into the wall on either side of the pulpit, and they're all staring at the memorial plaques for the dead. It's the breakfast table, but now in a chapel, silent, islands of men and women, staring at what? The fact of death, heaviness, morbidity. There is no joy in this. This isn't worship. And we're into, again, part of that religious vision of the book. And it is a fundamental truth about the way America worships. Singly, solely, cut off. There is not that sense of warm charity binding worshipers together. From the breakfast table to the chapel, we are solitary. We are isolated. Now, we get the comic side of that in the opening chapters. And this book, which is a tragedy, I'll talk more about that later. The design of this book is a tragedy. We can be proud as Americans. Our greatest work is a tragedy. Tragedy is one of the noblest expressions of the mind of men. It's only occurred a few times in all human history. The Greeks, Elizabethan England, and the 19th century in Russia with the great tragic novels, and one book in America about a whale. But it's a tragedy. Please notice that none of those that I named are specifically Catholic contexts. Catholicism much more tends to yield comedy, whether it be a divine comedy or what we're going to witness tonight with the genius of Flannery O'Connor. Real Catholicism tends to render great comedy, okay? Troubled faith gives us tragedy. I made the point Shakespeare was a believer, but a troubled believer living in a time of religious upheaval, going through a furnace of doubt, we get tragedy. Okay? Melville, a man haunted by these questions, we get tragedy. But the book opens with some of the great comic writing ever. The scenes of Ishmael finding his bed partner is the cannibal Queequeg is uproariously funny. This is funny stuff. But what we're also getting is a presentation of something, one of two sides. What I'm going to do in the few minutes remaining is pose the religious question as it is presented at the beginning of the book. We'll explore it more fully later. And we get it in comic form. Turn, if you will, to... I'm at the end of chapter 10. And at the end of chapter 10, a bosom friend. This is a comic presentation of something that's going to become a very serious idea in the book. But he presents the theme first comically. I'm in the next to last paragraph, end of chapter 10. He's seeing Queequeg, who's covered with tattoos, right? Queequeg comes in, disrobes at night, and the body is tattooed from head to foot. He could be a modern punker. I was down in Winona yesterday and drove by the tattoo and body piercing parlor. Okay, if you want evidence we're becoming savages, young America is trying to Queequegize itself. Let me put it that way. it's going on out there. Tattoos from head to foot, just like Queequeg. Here's Ishmael. And this is Ishmael who claims to... This is Ishmael the believer talking about his religion. I was a good Christian. I love it. That's the voice of America. I'm a good Christian. I believe in God. Yeah. I was a good Christian, born and bred in the bosom of the infallible Presbyterian Church. How then could I unite with this wild idolater in worshiping his piece of wood? It's the little idol Yojo that Queequeg has pulled out and is worshiping. How then could I unite with this wild idolater in worshiping his piece of wood? But what is worship, thought I? Do you suppose now, Ishmael, that the magnanimous God of heaven and earth, pagans and all included, can possibly be jealous of an insignificant bit of black wood? Impossible. But what is worship? To do the will of God. That is worship. And what is the will of God? To do to my fellow man what I would have my fellow man do to do to me. That is the will of God. Now, Queequeg is my fellow man. And what do I wish that this Queequeg would do to me? Why, unite with me in my particular Presbyterian form of worship. Consequently, I must then unite with him in his. Ergo, I must turn idolater. That is a comic sequence, but the logic leads to the American heresy that entered the church in Vatican II. And that's scary stuff. We begin with a comic presentation, but what we are watching is each man his own church, each man his own priest, each man his own cunt. I decide it all, and should I fall into faulty logic, how could I? I'm impeccable. I'm a good Christian. And because I'm a good Christian, the paragraph begins, I must turn idolater. Now, one more quick example of this. We get some more of this. I'm in chapter 17, Queequeg's Ramadan. You'll note Queequeg's devout. He may be a cannibal, but he is a devout cannibal. Unlike Ishmael, who really doesn't believe much of any. He keeps saying, I'm a good Presbyterian. He has the depth of religious faith that most Americans have. I'm a good church-going man. Haven't been in the last couple of years, but I believe all that. Chapter 17, this is going to be tough. About a third of the way through, two-thirds of the way through the chapter. Paragraph begins, Now as I before hinted, I have no objection to any person's religion, be it what it may, so long as that person does not kill or insult any other person, because that other person don't believe it also. But when a man's religion becomes really frantic, when it is a positive torment to him, and in fine, makes this earth of ours an uncomfortable inn to lodge in, then I think it high time to take that individual aside and argue the point with him. If I encounter somebody who really believes something, to the point that that person is actually seriously considering religious matters, and may be troubled by and living in a way that makes life uncomfortable, well, now, just a minute, that's good. I've got to take that person and say, religion's fine and good in its place. You know, we can go on Sunday and sing a hymn and have a good weep and feel warm and runny inside and shake hands and give a hug and, you know, go back to life. But, I mean, what are you fasting? Are you crazy? What, you want to talk to me about what this means? I don't want to talk to you about that. I've got other things to think about. That'll make me uncomfortable. Here we are. Melville knew it. Now, he balances this, and I've just got a few minutes left right now, he balances this with a great sermon. I'm not going to go through Father Mapple's sermon. But let's just say Father Mapple's sermon is good, solid doctrine. Father Mapple goes into that chapel, that's the whaleman's chapel, goes up into that pulpit that's built like a ship, pulls the rope ladder up after him, and gives a fire and brimstone sermon on, what else? Jonah and the whale. And what are his basic points? One, Jonah was the God fugitive. Jonah tried to flee from God. Jonah was given a mission by God, and Jonah chose to get up and get out of there. And suddenly we're back with the vision of the exile, the outcast, that is Ishmael, who is our narrator. Okay? And what we're getting in between there is, wait a minute, we may have a whole nation of God fugitives. We may have a whole nation that is running from God. We may have a whole country that was given a mission by God and has chosen to do what? Well, I'll just go to sea. I'll just get out of here. Number two, Father Mapple says, if you try to flee God, you will fail. Because the world is God's and the fullness thereof, and you try to flee from Him, and the next thing you know, you're going to find yourself in the belly of the whale. Because God's creatures, many of them, will do God's bidding, and you may be trying to escape, but the next thing you know, gloom, and down you go. At which point, you can then reflect on how wise it is to flee from God. The God fugitive will fail in his flight. Because you cannot escape the will of God, says Father Mapple. And eventually, you're going to be shown that fact. It will dawn on you, at which point, there will be a change, a new recognition, and after the attempt to escape comes the need for repentance. And Jonah realizes, whoa, I made a mistake, and now I'm sorry. This is a great phrase. This is dark. This is dark, but there is truth here. Jonah was not clamorous for pardon, says Father Mapple, but grateful for punishment. Having sinned, having fled, it's not just pardon me, it's punish me, for I deserve it. Okay? We're getting a Christianity tinged with that dark vision of Calvinism. But there is truth. There is some truth there coming from Father Mapple. And finally, after that comes humility. And Jonah simply then becomes God's agent, goes to Nineveh, does what he's supposed to do, but does it with great, great humility. And ends his sermon. I'll just give the quick quote. Yet this is nothing. I leave eternity to thee, for what is man that he should live out the lifetime of his God? Melville could do this. I mean, Father Mapple's sermon is there at the beginning of the book that is loaded with enough Christian truth that it balances this peculiar vision that we're getting from Ishmael. And then, and I have to just do a quick running commentary on this. The moment when Ishmael goes to sign on to the whaling ship and meets Captains Bildad and Peleg, one of whom sitting there reading the Bible aloud, okay, while the other is getting the sailors to sign up to go out on the voyage, okay? And what is he reading? He's a very devout man, this Quaker, okay? And what is it he's reading? I'll just give it to you. Got 72. Okay. Bildad is reading over and over again, lay not up for yourselves treasures upon earth, where moth and rust, okay. Don't worry about money. He's reading it aloud from the scripture over and over as the sailors are coming to sign up to get their return for the, don't worry about money. The good book says money's not important, says the owner of the ship, okay. They're running a con game. It's a con game. It's an old-fashioned American con game where the one captain is saying, okay, sign up, and you'll get this percentage of the take. And Ishmael's drops from the 200-something to the 700th-something, and the captains are saying, well, that's good because you're not concerned with money. Say the captains, as what are they doing? Getting more money for themselves. It is a very funny scene, but it is a frightening vision of an America where the good book is an excuse for making profit. I'm a good Christian. I can prove it to you. Look at the money I'm making for myself. It's everywhere. It's everywhere, okay? And the con game is played brilliantly. And then finally, we get this comment. It's something, these men are Quakers. They are Quakers, and what are they doing? They're sending men out on whaling ships to kill whales. I'll just give you this paragraph. Now, Bildad, like Peleg, and indeed many other Nantucketers, was a Quaker, the island having been originally settled by that sect. And to this day, its inhabitants, in general, retain in an uncommon measure the peculiarities of the Quaker, only variously and anomalously modified by things altogether alien and heterogeneous. They're still Quakers. They're just really strange Quakers. For some of these same Quakers are the most sanguinary of all sailors and whale hunters. They are fighting Quakers. They are Quakers with a vengeance. Magnificent. Here we have the good, God-fearing, peaceable Quakers who are what? Bloody whale hunters and can't get out there and slice this creature to pieces and soak in its blood. The good, pious Quakers. And Melville goes right to the core of what I would call the fundamental American characteristic. We are all schizophrenic, and our two sides are fighting each other, just like the peace-loving Quakers are bloodthirsty men. When does the ship sail out? On Christmas Day. We don't worship. We don't stay at home. It may be that day to rejoice in our Lord's incarnation, but the sea is filled with whales, and there's money to be made. And off we get on that ship, not really knowing who our captain is, even though we've been warned by the prophet Elijah, this crazy man who tries to stop us from going on board. No matter, we're on the ship, and we're heading out. And since I've come now to matters nautical, I'll let a good Navy man take up and follow from here at 11 o'clock.